well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. Hopefully you had a great weekend. I did not do any of the yard work that I needed to do. That's okay. That's what weekdays are for, right? But I did have a great weekend with the family. One of my kids had a birthday over the weekend, and it was good. Good to be with family. So, hope you had a good weekend as well. We're going to be talking with a member of the 2A family, Attorney Daniel Schmutter, who is one of the attorneys in New Jersey doing yeoman's work defending our right to keep and bear arms. Last week, the Third Circuit Court of Appeals heard oral arguments in a couple of related cases. Coons and Siegel, both taking on the state of New Jersey's post-Bruin carry regime. All of the rules for applying for a concealed carry license, as well as the litany of sensitive places where those with a concealed carry license are not allowed to venture forth so long as they have their gun on them. We're going to talk about that with Daniel Schmutter. Also, going to talk a little bit about just the environment for 2A-related businesses in the state of New Jersey. You know, we've recently been covering that case out of Somerville where a gun store wanted to open up for business, got all of its zoning approved, and then was sued along with the township by a resident. I guess the landlord of the property where that gun store is going to be located was sued as well, alleging that the location too close to a public school and just really didn't fit, you know, with the community in general. That type of hostility towards the fundamental right to keep and bear arms still on full display, unfortunately, in the Garden State. Let's talk about that and more with Dan Schmutter. Take a look and a listen. Dan, thanks so much for joining me on the program today. It's good to see you again, sir.
That's good to see you, Cam.
So we have we've had a lot of talk about the issue of high-capacity magazines. Last week, we saw the state of Oregon, federal judge said, yeah, you know, Oregon's magazine ban can go into effect. A Oregon Court of Appeals said, nah, hang on that because we got this challenge under state law as well. We're still looking at, you know, what's going on in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, what's going on in several other appellate courts. But the Third Circuit, you recently took part in oral arguments before that appellate court regarding New Jersey's ban on high capacity magazines, as well as the ban on so-called assault weapons, correct?
Well, the last week's argument on magazines and so-called assault firearms was in the district court, but there is a Third Circuit case out of Delaware, or several Third Circuit cases out of Delaware that were argued recently. So there's an interesting interaction potentially between the Delaware cases that were argued at the Third Circuit just a few weeks ago and our New Jersey cases that we argued before the district court last week. One interesting difference is that the Delaware cases are at the beginning. They're at the what's called a preliminary injunction stage. That is, the Delaware cases, they asked the court for an early temporary injunction to last during the case while they litigate. We're at the end of our cases. Our magazine case was is from 2018. And that went all the way up to the Supreme Court. We had a petition at the Supreme Court on the magazine case during Bruin, while Bruin was being decided. And because of the decision in Bruin, our magazine case was one of the cases that was sent back down to be as a do-over under Bruin. We then filed a case challenging New Jersey's so-called assault weapon law, along with another case that was filed as well by another organization. And now those three cases have been consolidated for decision by the district judge, and that we argued those last week. So these cases are all moving forward. As you mentioned, there are cases all over the country on this issue. This is a thoroughly, richly litigated issue in California, Delaware, New Jersey, Maryland, Oregon, Illinois. I mean, they're all over the place. And so they're sort of hurtling headlong towards the Supreme Court, I believe. And, you know, we'll see something at some point. Just the question is when and which case or cases.
Yeah. And thanks for correcting me about that. I confess we've now gotten to the stage of Second Amendment litigation where I can't keep track of all of these cases. I used to be able to do a pretty good job of recalling where these individual cases were at any point in time. Not so much anymore. But so this is at the trial court. But this was a case on the merits, right? This wasn't an argument, as you say, over an injunction or a temporary restraining order. This was the trial on the merits of New Jersey's bans.
Correct. As I mentioned, the our magazine case is now 6 years old. The so-called assault firearm cases are basically from 2022. But we've been through what's called discovery, where you may exchange information between the parties. Maybe you'll have expert reports. In this case, we did. There were a lot of experts in this case. There were some depositions. And then you get to the end of the case. And as frequently as is true in these kinds of cases, you file what's called a summary judgment motion. And what you're basically telling the judge is, we don't need a trial because the facts are not in dispute. Trials are for facts. If legal issues are for the judge, trials are to determine facts. And what the parties, and both parties filed summary judgment motions and said, we win without need for a trial because this is all issues of law or undisputed facts, and we're going to ask the court to just make a decision. We don't need a trial. And that's what was argued last week, what's called cross summary judgment motions. We filed summary judgment motions, the other side filed summary judgment motions, and we'll see what the judge does.
So what is New Jersey's argument in defense of its gun ban? Are they arguing that magazines are not arms that are protected by the Second Amendment? Are they arguing that there is some sort of longstanding national tradition of regulating the capacity of firearms? Where are they hanging their hat here?
Well, what's interesting about these cases, and it's really, it's not just the magazine and so-called assault weapon cases. It's all the cases now that are being litigated around the country, such as the sort of what some people refer to as the Bruin response laws, the concealed carry laws that substitute all sorts of restrictions in place of the restrictive permit requirements. So in the pre-Bruin states like New Jersey, New York, Maryland, et cetera, would have very onerous permit requirements so that you basically couldn't get a permit. Now that they can't do that, they have substituted all sorts of restricted places, which cover everywhere basically, and all sorts of much more onerous permitting requirements. Those cases are also being litigated in five different jurisdictions. And what we're seeing in those cases and the magazine and assault weapon cases is that the states are using the same arguments. They're recycling the same. They've come up with a national strategy to try to defeat these lawsuits wherever they're brought. So you're going to see the same basic arguments brought everywhere. And New Jersey is no exception. We're seeing the same basic arguments that magazines aren't arms, that there were restrictive laws, in the 19th century for bowie knives and trap guns and things like that and all sorts of other stuff. None of them are valid. None of them really hold any water, but they're making these arguments. And in the same time, they're trying to truck in all of the interest balancing that they're not supposed to be allowed to do. Your reviewers will recall that one of the things that Bruin did, the Supreme Court made it absolutely clear that interest balancing by judges, that is, comparing the banning of arms with the existence of arms, which is better? Do we emphasize criminal behavior versus the behavior and the choices of the law abiding? That's off the table, and that was off the table in the Heller decision.
Right.
The Supreme Court was absolutely clear that in Heller that you can't do that. Justice Breyer, in a dissenting opinion in Heller, proposed that that's what should be done, and the court said no. The Second Amendment did all the balancing we needed to do. The Second Amendment itself is the balance that the Constitution struck. You don't get to do that again each time you want to regulate the right to keep and bear arms. And so interest balancing was off the table in 2008. And yet, after McDonald versus Chicago, which is what opened the door to litigation against states in 2010, there was 12 years of interest balancing. And what was happening was the courts were doing it anyway. And in Bruin, the court said, no, we really mean it, no interest balancing. And what the court did in Bruin was to say, look, this is how you do this. Heller laid out the law and Heller laid out what the standards were, but Heller wasn't excruciatingly specific about the steps courts need to take in order to apply the Second Amendment. So and after 12 years of abuse by the lower courts, the court in Bruin said, okay, look, we're going to need to show you specifically how this works because for 12 years you were doing it wrong. Here's what you do. You see if the protected conduct or the allegedly protected conduct falls within the plain text of the Second Amendment. If it does, then the state has to show that the regulation is consistent with the historical tradition of firearms regulation. And that's what the court did in Heller, 14 years earlier, but many courts, most courts didn't get that. And so the court had to be very explicit in Berlin. And so these states have lost the ability to explicitly do interest balancing. So what are they doing? They are doing interest balancing, or they're trying to do it by bringing in all these experts talking about how awful firearms are, particularly black rifles, particularly so-called assault weapons, particularly magazines in excess of 10 rounds, which they call large capacity magazines, and you and I call standard capacity magazines, because that's what they are. And they bring in experts to talk about how different things are now than before. And they think that gets them to spread all the blood and gore on the record, just like the Supreme Court has twice now said they can't do. So that's what they're doing in these kinds of cases. And that's what if it works, ultimately it's a strategy they're going to continue doing in cases as much as they possibly can. The best thing that they can do is put experts on the stand, talk about wound cavities and mass shootings and all kinds of things that are terrible, but not constitutionally permissible. You know, there's all sorts of things that if we ignored the Constitution, states could do to regulate, to control people's behavior. We could allow warrantless searches. We could deny people the right to counsel. We could coerce confessions, beat confessions out of people. But it's not allowed. And so you can't just say, look how horrible crime is. We need to be able to violate people's rights in order to stop crime.
Yeah.
There are limitations imposed by the Constitution, and states have to respect them, and it's up to the courts to enforce those.
Absolutely. And as you say, I mean, in Heller, the Supreme Court noted handguns are the primary firearm of choice for people who want a gun for self-protection. They're also the primary firearm of choice for criminals. But just because, you know, handguns are predominantly used in crime as opposed to rifles or shotguns, that doesn't mean that you can ban them, right? The Supreme Court explicitly stated that. And now it seems like we're having that same argument when it comes to magazines. NSSF published a study last week showing, I think it was about 80%, just a little under 80% of the magazines that are possessed in this country are quote unquote large capacity. They have a capacity of more than 10 rounds. And what I thought was fascinating about this, Dan, is they looked at the magazines that were, you know, sold as part of the firearm itself and then aftermarket purchases. And overwhelmingly, you know, Americans are choosing to buy magazines that have a capacity of more than 10 rounds. When they have the choice, that is what they are choosing to purchase, which tells me that, yes, these are in common use. Yes, for lawful purposes like self-defense, but also for recreational shooting, competition, hunting, what have you. Right. And that's the other thing that the Supreme Court said when it comes to these hardware bans is that bearable arms are prima facie protected by the Second Amendment. Just because something wasn't around in 1791 doesn't mean it's not protected now, right? They said that in a katana with stun guns. And so in the issue of both magazines and, you know, modern sporting rifles, we're talking about things that are in common use by millions of lawful Americans. That, yes, some of them are used in crimes. But as you say, that can't be the tipping point. That can't be what turns a magazine into an illegal item. So what have you been able to introduce? Again, the burden's on the state to show that these bans fit with the text, history, and the tradition of gun ownership in this country. But what were you able to show the court in terms of these items being in common use and protected by the language of the Second Amendment?
Well, you know, you hit up on a very important concept in discussing common use and in terms of discussing choice. Because what Heller... The whole idea behind the common use test, and I hate the word common use because the problem is it's confusing. The actual language that Heller keys on in discussing this concept of common use is arms that are typically possessed by law-abiding individuals for lawful purposes. So the word use isn't in there, and the word common isn't in there in the actual phraseology. And so what's happened is states have said, oh, common use, okay, well then the plaintiffs, the gun owners and the organizations who are advocating for the constitutional right have to show how many times people squeeze the trigger at a bad guy in order to show common use for self-defense, which is not what the court says. That's a complete nonsensical burden, because that's not how deterrence, that's not how gun ownership works. Most people will never use their firearms in self-defense. Most people will never use their seatbelts to save them from a potentially fatal car accident. You have them. And so The concept of common use is about choice. What the common use test, or typical possession test, demonstrates and illustrates is the idea that the Second Amendment is about the people being the ones who make the choice of what arms they wish to possess for lawful purposes, including self-defense. And so it is not up to the state to decide what's appropriate for self-defense. For example, one of the witnesses that New Jersey has brought into our case is someone who argues that so-called assault weapons and so-called large capacity magazines are not appropriate for self-defense. And they pick the AR-15 platform as an example. This witness says that people should use revolvers to defend their homes. And that's fine for him. And if he wants to use a revolver, that's okay. But the problem is that everybody's situation is different. And so, you know, for him to say generally that all people should use a revolver for self-defense and the defense of their home and family is absurd. And it flies in the face of the whole idea behind the notion of common use. It is about what people choose to arm themselves with. And that's the key. And that goes hand in hand with the idea that it is about the law abiding. It's what law abiding do with respect to arms, not the criminal.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, we could go down a rabbit hole of defining law abiding, right? Because the Biden administration has taken the position that there is no real limiting authority there. You run a stop sign. Technically, you're not law abiding anymore. And they could take away your guns, although they say that they would never really view the law that way. But maybe, you know, legal gun owners might be a better way to describe that, right? Because when we start going down that road, then we start getting into the prohibited persons argument, which is probably a whole other topic of conversation. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, you know, we're going to get a little bit of insight into that no later than the end of June because of the Rahimi case.
Right.
That's before the Supreme Court. Now, so that's a prohibited person case under federal law. And so we'll have some sense of how that works. I don't know that Rahimi will necessarily answer all the questions about prohibited persons and who can be divested of the right to keep and bear arms under the Constitution, but we should have some sense of how at least some of that works from the Supreme Court. So over time, you know, these things get litigated over time, and the contours of the legal rules get fleshed out with each new case. So we know something about arms bans from Heller. We know something about people's choices in terms of the conduct outside the home from Bruin, because there's a right to carry. And we'll learn a little bit about prohibited persons and who can be constitutionally divested of the right to keep bear arms from Rahimi. So these things, you know, this is a marathon, not a sprint. This takes place over a considerable time. And we need, you know, we bring these cases and we bring different kinds of cases to sort of carve out and flesh out what the rule actually looks like, what the legal rule is that governs the constitutional rights.
Yeah. And, you know, to that end, I mean, you mentioned that this was one of the cases that the Supreme Court GVR'd. They granted cert, vacated the lower court decision, remanded it back down after Bruin. From a layman's perspective, Dan, that to me indicates that the Supreme Court wants a do-over because Bruin changed something, right? Otherwise, they wouldn't have done that. There must be something new to take away from Bruin that would apply to this case. Doesn't necessarily mean that the lower court's got it wrong, but there's a reason to revisit this issue. Yeah, we've seen, though, from like the Fourth Circuit, when it comes to Bianchi, the challenge to Maryland's so-called assault weapons ban, there are a lot of games being played here. You know, the Fourth Circuit originally held oral arguments before a three-judge panel. More than a year goes by, and all of a sudden the Fourth Circuit, even before that panel releases this decision, says, you know what, time out. We're actually going to take this en banc instead. A lot of folks think that was because they were the en banc panel was concerned that there was going to be a decision that was favorable for Second Amendment supporters, and they didn't want that on the record. Have you seen, how would you describe this experience in district court challenging New Jersey's ban on so-called assault weapons and large capacity magazines? Do you think the judge has played it straight from what you've been able to tell?
Well, it's very interesting. The judge acknowledged on the record that he doesn't really know anything about firearms. That was our sense, although he didn't say it the first time around. In the magazine case, when we were litigating in 2018, 2019, 2020. But he acknowledged that, which I think is a very fair acknowledgement. People have come up to me and said, well, how could that be? Why don't we have a judge that knows about firearms? And, you know, the answer to that is that judges are supposed to be generalists. They're not supposed to have particularized knowledge, except in very specific circumstances and particular kinds of specialized courts. Judges are generalists, and it's our job as lawyers and the job of the witnesses and the evidence to educate the judge as to what's going on. When you do this long enough, you realize that some judges do have a very anti-Second Amendment viewpoint and are particularly hostile to our positions. Some judges are very welcoming to the Second Amendment and have a good understanding and recognition of how it's supposed to work and how it does work. And then in the middle, you have judges that don't really have any particular viewpoint one way or the other, hopefully are open to being educated on what the law is and what the facts are. You know, when you come across the so-called anti-judges, the judges that you know are extremely hostile, you know you're unlikely to prevail, at least if they're the trial court. If they're on an appellate panel, you hope they're in the minority. And vice versa, when you have a judge that has shown a record of very, very robust understanding of the Second Amendment, you hope that they do the right thing, and you hope that you have a majority on an appellate panel, a majority of judges that have a clear and robust understanding of the rights. And then when you have judges in the middle, it's our job to really educate them because they don't know. So it's my job as the lawyer to present the evidence in a way that's compelling and to really educate them on the law so they understand what the correct result is from a legal and constitutional perspective and a factual perspective.
Yeah.
So, I think that last week, I think we had a fair hearing, an oral argument. I think it was generally a good day, but there's no way to, I've long since gotten out of the business of trying to predict what judges are going to do. It is a fool's errand.
Yeah.
You're always wrong when you try to predict these things.
Yeah.
So I don't do that anymore. I have absolutely no idea what the judge is going to do. There are a lot of issues to rule on, and there are two different kinds of cases in front of this judge. So he can rule one way in one and one way in the other. I mean, there's really no way to know. But I do think we had a fair hearing on Thursday, and I think we did the best we could, and so I think it was a pretty good day as oral arguments go, and that's really the most I can say about it, unfortunately.
Well, and that's the way I phrased the question I did, because I've learned not to ask, so do you think you're going to win? Because, obviously, attorneys, yes, you hope that you're going to be successful here, but you're right. You can't predict what a judge is going to do, even based on, sometimes you might be able to get an inkling based on questioning during oral arguments, but that's not always the case. So fingers crossed that we do get a good decision here from the district court judge. I want to ask you, too, while we've got you here, Dan, generally speaking, we've been talking about, the bans on magazines, the bans on quote unquote assault weapons. We've talked a little bit about the Bruin response in New Jersey, but I want to ask you, too, just about the general atmosphere surrounding the Second Amendment. Has anything changed on the ground in New Jersey since the Bruin decision came down? We obviously know we have a lot more concealed carry licensees, right? Some 30,000 concealed carry licensees, right, according to the Attorney General's office. But I'm still seeing these stories of, gun stores that are trying to open up. Somerville, for example, recently had this lawsuit that was filed by a resident who didn't like where the gun store was located. I don't think really liked the fact that a gun store was open in anywhere in town. But are you still seeing this sort of innate hostility towards people who are trying to exercise this fundamental civil right? Has Bruin changed anything in that respect in New Jersey?
Well, so it's an interesting question because there's a lot of moving parts there. I'll talk about the high caliber ordinance case. So I represented them as defendants in a state court litigation trying to shut them down, or trying to prevent them opening. They had not opened yet. And although nominally there was a single plaintiff, the plaintiff was actually a part of a group of folks on social media who were sort of coordinating and trying to stop them from opening. There was only one individual who became the named plaintiff, but it was a coordinated effort. And unfortunately, they had to defend against a lawsuit, which they shouldn't have had to do. The claims asserted were utterly frivolous. They filed the case pro se, meaning they didn't have a lawyer. And they really, this was a great example of trying to throw everything at the wall to see what would stick. And nothing stuck because it was all utterly baseless. And we fortunately, we were able to demonstrate to the judge that it was complete nonsense, and he dismissed the case. Now, on the other hand, one of the things that I've noticed in New Jersey, I say New Jersey because this is where I am, and I'm most focused on New Jersey, the firearms community and the Second Amendment community in New Jersey is astonishingly energetic and active. Second Amendment folks have enormous participation. They are vocal. They are energetic. They are smart. They're resourceful. It is really amazing to watch. And I see it at events, but I also see it on social media. For example, at the hearing on the summary judgment hearing on Thursday, the only non-lawyers in the room were Second Amendment supporters, and they came in T-shirts and they were very respectful and they were very polite and very well behaved, but they were there. The other side wasn't there. And so, you know, people, there's a lot of publicity about the anti-Second Amendment movement. They get a lot of news coverage. But my personal experience is that the pro-Second Amendment people, the pro-Second Amendment movement is incredibly fired up, very energetic, very motivated, very smart, and very very effective in how they get the message out and their participation and their activism. And I'm very proud of the folks in New Jersey. It's very gratifying to watch.
Absolutely, it is. So last question, Dan, and I've started trying to ask this of all of the Second Amendment attorneys who come on the show, just because I'm curious. How did you decide to start handling 2A cases? What made you decide that this was an area of interest and concern for you?
Well, there's two pieces, two answers to that question. So I became a gun owner years ago. I didn't grow up with firearms. I grew up in New York City in the Bronx, in a very left-wing environment. And so I was, you know, subject to all the propaganda about firearms that New Yorkers, grew up with.
Right.
But I went to law school at the University of Virginia. And so going to law school in the South, it's a wonderful experience to go to school in a place that's totally different than you know, very much different than how you grew up. And so I learned how to shoot in law school. And then when I came to New Jersey and I was a gun owner, New Jersey was, this was, I'm going to say 93, maybe, I forget when New Jersey passed the one gun a month law. When New Jersey was proposing their one gun a month law, I wrote an op-ed in the New York Star Ledger newspaper. And it was in opposition to the proposed one gun a month law. And I got a call from someone you know very well, Scott Bach, who is the executive director of the Association of New Jersey Rifle and Pistol Clubs and a board member of the National Rifle Association. He called me up and he said, so I read your piece in the Star Ledger. I really enjoyed it. Why don't I know you? And that started a relationship that has grown. I'm very proud to call Scott a very close friend of mine today. But, you know, his activism, both with NRA and ANJRPC, the Association of New Jersey Rifle and Pistol Clubs, got me involved in the movement. And then, interestingly, there was a case that in 2003, I want to say, that was coming out of the Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit, which covers California and the West, you know, those West Coast states, called Silvera versus Lockyer. There was a petition for certiorari to the Supreme Court. That was actually a so-called assault weapon case. And I don't remember how I came across this. I came across some solicitation from Jews for the Preservation of Firearms Ownership, JPFO. They were looking for pro bono attorneys to help them do an amicus curiae brief, a friend of the court brief, as your viewers will be familiar with. And so I thought, well, that's interesting. Second Amendment, that's kind of cool. So that's something I'm interested in. How that would be fun, right, to do something like that. And so I applied, and they selected me to lead a group of actually three lawyers to be lead counsel to do an amicus brief at the petition stage. Now, this is something was brand new to me. I really knew nothing about the strategy and tactics associated with Supreme Court practice and civil rights practice. And so I got involved in a case which never should have been filed. That would have been the worst possible case to be the first. This is pre-Heller. So that would have been the worst possible case to go to the Supreme Court as the first Second Amendment case basically ever. But what did I know? I was, you know, I was brand new to this stuff. In retrospect, knowing what I know now, it would have been terrible. Had that been granted cert, it could very well have been a disaster. Fortunately, Heller was the first case that got to the Supreme Court, and you know, the rest is history. So that kind of introduced me. I did an amicus brief in Heller for JPFO. I did an amicus brief in McDonald for JPFO, and then began litigating in earnest on behalf of my own clients on the merits as parties in the case. So that was really my introduction, that amicus practice at the very beginning of this stuff. And then that kind of morphed into a very, very steep learning curve about civil rights cases and about the Second Amendment law. And that's here I am today.
That's fantastic. I love it. I love the fact, yeah, I'm about an hour south of Charlottesville. So I love the fact that you learned to shoot here locally. And if you ever come back, you let me know, because I'd love to go shooting with you again.
Absolutely. It's a deal, Cam.
That is fantastic. Listen, Dan, thank you so much for everything you're doing for gun owners in New Jersey. Again, we have no idea when the judge is going to release their decision in this case. They don't telegraph that sort of thing. But I would love to have you back when we do get a decision here.
Absolutely, Cam. It'd be my pleasure.
All right, Dan Schmutter, thank you so much for your time today. Thank you for everything you do, and look forward to doing this again very soon.
Thank you, Cam.
My thanks to Dan for joining me on the program today, and looking forward to hopefully getting some good news out of the Third Circuit regarding the right to carry in the not-too-distant future. Before we turn our attention to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our Armed Citizen story, let's talk about this for a second. At the very heart of our democracy lies a principle that we hold sacred: free speech. It's the cornerstone that supports every freedom we cherish. Yet in today's digital age, discussions about our wealth, our rights, and our future are being silenced or overshadowed in mainstream narratives, leaving many feeling voiceless in conversations that are crucial to our financial independence and security. That is where Wealth Protection Research steps in. Armed with a mission that's never been more critical, Wealth Protection Research is not a financial advisory firm. They're defenders of free speech, committed to giving a voice to the silenced. Wealth Protection Research tirelessly seeks out financial experts. These are the voices that challenge prevailing narratives, especially as we navigate the uncertainties of the 2024 election. Wealth Protection Research has created a 2024 Election Wealth Protection Report. This free report highlights the three best ideas for protecting and growing your money heading into the 2024 election. It contains ideas the mainstream media won't touch, and listeners can get it completely free. Text IDEAS to 76626 to claim your free copy. If you believe in the sanctity of free speech and the importance of financial freedom, then act now. Text IDEAS to 76626 to claim your free copy of this 2024 Election Protection Report. It's time to widen the scope of what we're told, to hear the ideas that the establishment doesn't think you can handle, and to take control of our financial destinies. Text IDEAS to 76626 to claim your free copy. All right, now let's get to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. We will start there with a story out of Rochester, New York, where a robbery charge was the third arrest in a month for a Rochester man named Joseph Mullen. Shots fired in this particular robbery. Yeah. According to Rochester police, Mullen allegedly robbed a man at gunpoint a month ago. At least one shot was fired, but the victim wasn't hurt. He was arrested for the robbery on Friday morning. Before that most recent arrest, he had been arrested on March 21st after accidentally shooting himself with a gun that he possessed illegally. He was arrested again a week later after police say he broke into a home and threatened a person with a handgun before running off. So here you have three gun-related incidents involving somebody who's not legally allowed to possess a firearm, or at least did not possess that gun legally in New York. And in each and every case, he's arrested. He is quickly released, goes on to commit, allegedly, another crime, is arrested, is quickly released. Yeah. And meanwhile, as we wrote about at Bearing Arms earlier today, you know, I said that E. Jean Carroll maybe was getting the sweetheart treatment because of who she was. The individual who, you know, sued Donald Trump apparently admitted during her defamation trial, where she's suing the president for defamation, that she keeps a gun, unlicensed, in her home for self-defense. Now, she wasn't even arrested. Instead, the police in Warwick, New York, went out to her home, said, "Hey, you know, Miss Carroll, you really do need to have a license for this. Why don't you let us hold on to your pistol for you while you get that licensing taken care of? And then once you get all your paperwork in order, we'll give you your revolver back." I mean, that alone It's pretty extraordinary. But I guess even if you are accused of committing a violent crime, you don't really have to worry about any consequences, at least not in Rochester, New York. Because, again, three times in a month, Joseph Mullen has been arrested for a gun-involved incident. And each and every time, he's been quickly returned to the streets. All right. Today's Armed Citizen story from Lancaster, Pennsylvania, where a odd road rage shooting has been determined to be an act of self-defense. Now, why is this odd? Because typically road rage shootings involve, or road rage incidents involve, two motorists. Not this one. Involved a motorist and a cyclist who was shot in this road rage incident. According to authorities, the incident took place back on March 13th. Authorities in Lancaster County say Robin McGill was traveling down the road on a bicycle. There were multiple vehicles trailing behind him. He stopped on the road, causing traffic to come to a full and complete stop. One driver ended up honking their horn right behind McGill. He eventually moved out of the lane of traffic, allowing the cars to proceed. Ultimately, those cars stop at a red light. Police report that McGill chased down the vehicle that honked at him and then tried to force himself inside that car. The driver then produced a handgun, fired one shot at McGill's chest abdomen area, then pulled over, called 911, and waited with McGill until authorities arrived. The Lancaster County DA's office found that the driver was legally justified in using deadly force against McGill. Law states that if someone is forcibly or illegally entering a vehicle, the driver is within their right to use deadly force to protect themselves. Police report that the driver was in legal possession of the fire. McGill was not fatally injured. He is going to recover from his injuries. He is now facing charges of disorderly conduct. And again, the driver of that vehicle, not facing any charges at all. I say this every time I write about a road rage incident. Don't. It doesn't matter how much of a jackass you think the other person on the road is. Keep going. And you know what? 90 seconds from now, you're going to have forgotten all about it, right? That's it. You just move on. You go about your day. You get home, you complain. You never believe what this crumb bum did on the road today. Don't have anything to complain to. Go online. I'm not a huge fan of social media, but you know what? Even spouting off about the jackass on the road is better than trying to engage said jackass at the time. And by the way, in this particular case, honking because you stopped in the middle of the road, that's not jackass behavior. I would do the same. Maybe even roll down my window and give the middle finger salute, as a matter of fact. So, no, again, just take a deep breath, move on. Don't let others on the road ruin your day, and don't be the jackass that stops in the middle of the road. Don't be the guy that ruins other people's day, too, right? All right. Finally today, our good deed of the day, in the right place, at the right time, when unable to do the right thing. A man at a Kentucky Walmart who saved the life of his friend when he collapsed right in front of him. This happened just a few days ago in Rockcastle County, Kentucky. Paul Morgan is a dad, grandpa, former mechanic, and now you can add lifesaver to his resume. He was outside the Walmart in Rockcastle County when he saw a longtime buddy, Larry, in the parking lot. So they're standing there chatting, as you do when you run into old friends. Morgan said, "We were talking and going on," and he turned and he looked at me, and his eyes just lit up. And then he just fell like a tree and hit the concrete. And I thought he was dead, I'll be honest with you, he said. And he just started turning blue, and I thought, Lord, don't let him die. Mr. Morgan gave his friend Larry CPR, was able to restore a pulse and get Larry breathing before paramedics even arrived. He watched the ambulance take him away. So when they were loading him up, he looked at me and he said, "I'll see you, Paul." And I knew then he was going to be all right. Paul Morgan spent 2 years in the military. That's where he learned CPR. It's been more than 60 years since he has received that training. But he said it all came back to him when he needed it. He said he don't forget it. It's just like learning to drive or ride a bicycle. One of Paul Morgan's grandchildren, Eric Bullock, said, "Papa always thinks of other people before himself. It's not really about him. He just wants to do what he can for other people." Well, I'm glad that Paul Morgan was in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing for his buddy Larry. He said, "Life's so uncertain, and I think the most important thing is to be ready to go. I'd do it again for anybody." Well, I hope that Paul Morgan never has to put those skills to use again, but I'm glad that he had them in his memory. He was able to call on his own training decades earlier, and again, save the life of his buddy there in the parking lot of the Walmart in Rockcastle County, Kentucky, in the right place at the right time, willing able to do the right thing. Paul Morgan, we thank you for your very, very good deed. That is all the time we've got for you on this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam & Company. I want to thank you for being a part of the program as well. I'm looking forward to being back with you again tomorrow. Tomorrow, by the way, will be the 20th anniversary of the very first Cam & Company, which made its debut April 16th, 2004. We're going to be talking, we're not going to be looking back too much, I promise. I'm a big believer in looking ahead, and we're going to be looking ahead at what the ATF's new rule involving who is engaged in the business of selling firearms, what that's going to mean for private gun owners around the country. Retired ATF Assistant Director Pete Fricelli is going to be with us on the program. We'll be talking about the new ATF rule, as well as an armed citizen story. Again, another recidivist report, our good deed of the day. We'll see you back here tomorrow. In the meantime, be sure to check out BearingArms.com throughout the day for the latest Second Amendment news and information. And if you like what you see, become a VIP or VIP Gold member as well. Just go to BearingArms.com/subscribe. Use the promo code SAVEAMERICA. Get a significant savings on your membership. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Until then, be well, be safe, and be free.